Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
Take the last train of Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30 because I've made your reservation.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Something happened to music in the mid-60s. In 1966, the Monkees rode Last Train to Clarksville to the top of the charts, landing alongside California Dreaming and Winchester Cathedral.
Winchester Cathedral, the armor ringing me down.
That same year, rock music aligned with the social changes sweeping the country and the availability of LSD, opening up a countercultural approach to reality and spirituality.
Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. It is not dying.
That's the Beatles' Tomorrow Never Knows. The Rolling Stones also hit it big that year with Paint It Black, representing the darker side of the spiritual rebellion that gave rock its initial power. From Robert Johnson's mythical deal with the devil to the coded message in Led Zeppelin songs to the devilish imagery of heavy metal, the drive for the divine encounter rode shotgun with rock and roll, fueled by references to magic, arcane mysticism, Satan, the occult, and lots of drugs. It also kept rock and roll from dissolving into the sugary waste of the pop charts. And that is the theory put forth by author Peter Biebergall in a new book called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. Peter Biebergall, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me again. Really a pleasure to be here.
So where did that legend about Robert Johnson making a deal with the devil at the crossroads come from, anyway?
What's interesting about the Robert Johnson myth is it really wasn't Robert Johnson originally that even knew about that idea about himself. It was another Johnson who had perpetuated a myth of learning how to play the guitar by meeting the devil at the crossroads. But this idea of a devil at the crossroads really comes from a West African and Haiti religious traditions whereby there were these deities, Legba, Father Legba in particular, who was a crossroads deity. He acted as a mediator between heaven and earth, or the spirit world, as it were. And when this deity made its way across the ocean over to America, he was transformed into the devil, because any of these deities that Africans had brought with them to the United States were not going to fit well with the Christianity that was important for them to be absorbed into.
Well, decent, God-fearing people have been saying rock and roll is the devil's music since it first broke through to white America. And even before that, the same charge was made of the blues, largely helped along by the myth of Robert Johnson's deal with the devil. What did you find about the origins of this association?
Well, I think that the first thing that was scaring white people was when they would catch their slaves in the South, slave owners, doing their what were called their hush harbor worship, which was a kind of Christian worship. They took to the story of salvation that was sort of forced onto them when they arrived in America, but they found their own way to worship using something in particular called the ring shout, which involved a very evocative and loud way of yelling out their worship of God. But that tradition of worship, that way of being religious, came with them from Africa. And so even though they were believing as Christians, they were worshiping as pagans, as their tribal past. And that was a very frightening thing for the white establishment to see. They saw that kind of rhythm. They heard that sounds of those drums as barbaric, as devilish. And they saw Christianity as something that could clean it out of them.
So later on, those traditions were carried into the black church. And there is the old trope about singing the blues on Saturday and then being in the pews on Sunday morning. The music essentially the same, the lyrics changed. You make the point that the blues actually offered some solutions that the church didn't.
That's right. And there's a wonderful variety of blues songs that speak very explicitly about using forms of voodoo or voodoon as a way to charm the woman that you love or try to make a little extra money. And so these obviously are practices that would have – that the church would not have approved of. But people don't always live their faith exactly as the church would have them. And so you have a tradition that was brought to the South coming from these different countries like Haiti and West Africa and bringing along with them these traditions that involved what we would call occult practices. And that easily made its way into the music.
So there is a spiritual rebellion that rose along with what became rhythm and blues and rock and roll music. Here's an example. Here's the Isley Brothers Shout, parts 1 and 2, evoking the church and that uncut emotion that was feared by white America.
You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout. Come on now, don't forget to say you will. Don't forget to say yeah.
Say you will.
Say it right now, baby.
Say you will.
Come on, baby. Come on.
Say you will.
Say it better,
yeah.
Such an irony there that Elvis Presley, who brought black music to white America, was feared for his swiveling hips, which he said he learned where? In the Pentecostal church.
That's right. And there's a wonderful story of an early Pentecostal preacher who's trying to get his congregants to shout and to dance and to praise the Lord. And he says, "We can't let the devil keep all this good rhythm."
When you say that the occult saved rock and roll, we should clarify what you mean by occultism, which you define pretty broadly.
Very broadly. So really what I want to talk about and what I talk about in the book is the occult imagination. And the occult imagination includes both the ways in which people believe. People have always long believed in spirits and the spirit world and being able to communicate with them and being able to divine the future and being able to cast a spell. It was very part of really of early religion. People have also been afraid of those practices. People saw those in opposition to mainstream religions where you had somebody mediating those things for you. You shouldn't be on your own, left to your own devices to try to speak to spirits. There are priests and rabbis who take care of that business for you. So you have really this whole spectrum of the ways in which people both are afraid of it, believe in it, maybe don't believe in it at all, but are interested in the humor of it or how it can be used to sell an album by putting an upside down pentagram on the cover.
So it's less nefarious than kind of casting aside the convention, which is endemic to rock and roll. And so is, or was, sexuality. Now, where does that more decadent search for salvation come into this?
Well, I think sex is absolutely the essential way to spiritually rebel because sex is long used as an indicator of sin, of being on the side of the devil. And so when you have a sense of sexual freedom and you can somehow underpin that, say in the 60s, with a sense of spiritual freedom as well, well, now you've really charged it up.
So you point out that this is cynical in a sense, or let's say calculated, you know, a great way to sell an album. But there were genuine seekers there. And I want to talk
Absolutely.
About Jimmy Page and Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin. Here is some of that mythical imagery, in this case, Tolkien characters in the song Ramble On. This is from Led Zeppelin 2.
Just in the darkest depths of Mordor, I met a girl so fair. But Gollum at the evil wall crept up and slipped away with her, yeah. I did nothing happen to her. I guess I'll keep on rambling. I'm gonna
On the early pressings of the album that followed were etched the words, "Do what thou wilt." Now, this is a core belief of the English occultist Aleister Crowley. Jimmy Page had a kind of Crowley fixation, but you point out that it wasn't satanic.
No, and is it, you know, there's long been the association that anything occult has to do with Satan. And I think sometimes occultists like Aleister Crowley at the time liked to continue that association because it gave him an aura of being dangerous, who had access to hidden knowledge. But we're really talking about somebody who saw the occult as a means of personal liberation, of personal freedom. And again, we can look all through back and look at artists and musicians, and we can see that this idea of artistic freedom was often tied with a spiritual freedom. And that often meant having to bump up against both the mainstream artistically and the mainstream religiously. So in the case of these young musicians at the time, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page, doing something that was so unique and having access suddenly to a lot of money and things that they didn't have before allowed them to explore ideas that they maybe didn't necessarily have access to, or at least be able to dig a little bit deeper. And so I think it's very normal for somebody their age at the time to be interested in these kinds of things in the same way their fans were. But they could take it a little bit further because they had the means, and they also had music, which was a way for them to express these ideas.
And they had an audience.
Yes, and they changed rock and roll.
We're talking with the author Peter Biebergall, who says that rock's essential rebellious spirit is a spiritual rebellion at its core. He's the author of a new book called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. And he makes the case that all of the alternative and countercultural spiritualism that was brewing in mid-century America found a perfect vehicle in rock and roll and spread it to the masses. Well, how many kids slow dancing to Stairway to Heaven? You know, I remember that. Yeah, studying album covers and lyrics and looking for clues into meanings. But look at Charles Manson's claim that the White Album commanded him to murder, several murders in the 1960s. Couldn't teenagers or anyone with enough time divine whatever meaning they wanted from this music, occultist or not?
Absolutely. And that's kind of the danger, I guess, of any kind of magical thinking and really in any kind of religious or spiritual idea. I mean, the thing about we go to great lengths to try to separate occult thought from what we might call traditional religious thought. But really, some of the same psychological activities are at play, which is accepting the idea of some transcendent reality, accepting the idea that somehow human beings can have some interaction with the divine. And so whether you are a Christian fundamentalist or whether you are a believer in the occult, you could spend time looking for symbols and trying to extract meaning. What's amazing about rock and roll was that what we might call the occult imagination found a perfect vehicle in this music to express itself.
Well, I think of Mick Jagger, you know, prancing around with the sort of persona of the devil and singing Sympathy for the Devil, a song more about the chaos of the 60s. But for him, it was about the power over audiences that it conferred. And likewise, you know, you write about Black Sabbath later admitting that their darkness was calculated, social and spiritual defiance for working class boys. And wasn't that also true of listeners and fans, you know, glomming onto some kind of mystery that might distinguish them from their family or their peers?
That's right. And we do that all the time. I mean, let's take a moment where we go to see a magic show. I mean, we live in, you know, it's 2014, and anybody who goes to see a magician, even on the street or in a theater, knows that there's a trick, knows that it's not real magic. And yet we go into those situations allowing ourselves to be hypnotized by that. We want to be enchanted. And the same with the fans and their music. There's, I think, the very same transmission that's going on between the magician and the audience, the musician and the audience, and maybe even in ancient religious traditions, the shaman and the tribe.
You write also about David Bowie's obsession with aliens, you know, Yes's album covers, prog rock, Hotel California, Jay-Z playing with Illuminati symbols and goths. When did this all stop, Peter?
I don't think it's actually stopped. I do think there's a new generation of musicians who are seeing what can actually be really fun about these ideas, that maybe, you know, we're not living in a time where, like in the 70s, where you could go buy your ESP testing cards in the bookstores. But there's certainly a whole new generation that is in love with horror movies, that's in love with comic books, that wants to play Dungeons and Dragons, that still is interested in the fantastic and the fantastical. And even though science sort of dominates our understanding of the world, that there's still a way that we can let this imagination have its place in our pop culture. And there's many musicians that are still seeing that, you know what, there's something really interesting about the way these images and these ideas can be presented and can actually enhance the experience of listening to this music.
Anyone you can think of that's doing it particularly well?
Well, there's a really great underground movement, although the underground today really doesn't function in the same way. There's a band called Sun. And the lead is
S-U-N or S-O-N?
Well, they spell it S-U-N, and then there's a O with a bunch of closed parentheses. and they model it after actually an amplifier company named Sun, and that was their logo. And the lead of that, or really the creative force behind it, is a fellow named Stephen O'Malley. And what he's doing is he stages Sun concerts where they literally wear robes and have fog machines. And he uses the language of heavy metal, but is really producing some incredible, almost orchestral kind of rock and roll with down-tuned guitars and deep, heavy sounds that going to one of their concerts, it's so loud that you can actually feel it vibrating in your chest. And I think he really sees that there's a way of mixing these ideas, these images, and this music, something that maybe is a little bit sinister sounding, and it can actually transport you.
So, Peter, were the preachers right all along? Is rock and roll really the devil's music?
It certainly is.
Peter Biebergall, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Biebergall is author of 3 books, most recently Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. You'll find more, including some reviews of the book, at wordofmouthradio.org.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul away.
Thank you so much for listening today. We promise that if you played this show backwards, there would be no messages that will compromise your immortal or mortal soul. And that's true of everything at wordofmouthradio.org, where there's a full archive, so if you missed any part of the show, you can catch up. You can also subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it on iTunes or find the link at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks for helping us spread the word on Word of Mouth. And join us for more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.